Ballistic Chronicles.
You found Ballistic Chronicles. This is Gary Lewis. I'm your host. I'm an outdoor writer, television host of Frontier Unlimited. And you can find my articles in magazines like Game and Fish West and Oregon Hunter Magazine, Salmon Trout Steelheader, and a whole bunch of other magazines that I write for throughout the course of the year. And today we're going to talk with one of my favorite outdoor writers. His name is M.D. Johnson. He loves walleye fishing and duck and goose hunting, and he lives in Southwest Oregon, where he's also a blacktail hunter. So we talk about blacktail hunting from the perspective of growing up in Southwest Washington. That's where I'm from. And then going back there as an adult and as a mule deer hunter and a whitetail hunter, and how the things that we learn as mule deer hunters and whitetail hunters, how they translate to blacktail hunting and how they don't translate to blacktail hunting. So this is an episode about blacktail hunting and deer hunting in the brush in Western Oregon, Western Washington. And couple things that I'd like to mention that might not come up on the normal conversation is this season I'm going to be hunting with the new Model 21 from Nosler, and the caliber this year is going to be 26 Nosler. I'll be hunting blacktails with that caliber and the Nosler ABLR, which is the Accubond long range bullet. And then I'm carrying the CRKT Hunt and Fish. CRKT stands for Columbia River Knife and Tool. So I'll be carrying that knife, the Hunt and Fish. And a company that I've just become acquainted with recently is called Caribou Gear. And they make some really great game bags for packing in when you're doing these long distance mule deer hunts and blacktail hunts and moose hunts and elk hunts. So they tailor their game bags and their products to the backcountry hunter with food and cook systems and game bags, a product called the Hunter's Tarp, and then a new product that I'll be using this November on my rifle to pack it in, pack it out without getting the optics wet and keeping everything dry. It just really makes sense on some of these hunts where we're expecting rain. So their website is caribougear.com. So you can check that out. In this conversation with MD Johnson, he's interviewing me for Northwest Sportsman magazine, and this article is going to come out in October 2023 issue, so you can look for that one. This is a great time of the year to start putting your gear together and listen to podcasts. If you have optics with batteries in them, go in and replace all those batteries right now and start putting the gear aside, getting ready to go. I just did that myself last week with new batteries in the SIG rangefinder, the stabilizing binocular, and the SIG rifle scope that I'm putting on the 26 Nosler. Enjoy this episode with MD Johnson.
Hey guys, you are listening to Ballistic Chronicles. If you like the Ballistic Chronicles, tell your friends and check back here for the next episode. You can find Gary Lewis on Instagram @GaryLewisOutdoors. And now here's Ballistic Chronicles.
The years are a little bit different. The path is just a little bit different. I sold my first story to Gordy Cron, and the Trapper and Predator caller in 1986. And I'm not sure if I even got money for that. It's kind of like the present. And that's what I wanted to do. My mom was an English teacher. She's retired. Dad was biology teacher. He's retired. But I wanted to do something with the English language and writing and the outdoors. I worked at a car wash. I pumped gas. I worked for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources for a handful of years. Went full-time in 92, met Julie, then girlfriend, now wife in 93. She's a photographer, so it just worked incredibly well together. She did all the stuff that took organization, bookkeeping, inventory, and then she shot incredible photography, and I could basically hunt and do the writing and the things. I do love the fish. I'm huge on walleyes. I'm from the Midwest, 28 years in Ohio, 18 in Iowa. Love to walleye fish. We're in southwestern Washington. I wish there was a tremendous walleye fishery a little bit closer, so I didn't have to live vicariously through guys like Bill Saunders and the guys over there in the Tri-Cities who are catching all the walleyes. But I do like to salmon fish. I like to sturgeon fish. Ducks and geese, especially ducks, that's my first passion. I grew up on whitetails, and blacktails are still kind of a mystery to me. Actually, they're a lot of a mystery to me, which was my first, I guess, speaking point. I mean, you've been around the block. You've taken some very, very nice blacktails. Deer hunting, you just said, is one of your first loves. Are mature blacktail bucks seen in the daylight after September, are they even real? Or are we talking, you know, Bigfoot on the back of a unicorn kind of thing?
I've almost seen more Bigfoot than I have big blacktails in the open. Living in Southwest Washington, that's where I grew up. So where are you living right now?
We are in Wakayakum County. We are just outside of Cathlamet, town of Cathlamet in the Elokamon Valley.
You are a little ways from the good walleye fishing for sure. Okay. That's your question is the thing that I struggled with. And when I started, had a family and I was starting to make enough money where I could conceivably set some time aside to go out and go hunting, I started seeing your work popping up in the magazines that I was reading. And so when I became a writer, you were one of the people that I had paid attention to, because you were going down the path a little bit before me. And as you know, there is no path, but it's kind of like you were ahead of me in the forest with a flashlight.
Well, thank you. Is that like the sightless leading the sightless kind
of thing? Maybe? Yeah. Yeah. It's like that. So yeah, it is really hard to see big blacktail in the open after deer season starts. And so what happens for us first is we have archery season and then rifle season. And so then in Washington and Oregon, those deer are on alert, and your best opportunity is to be in the places where they go when they first get up to feed in the evening. And then in the morning, those places that they're moved through as they're headed back to their beds. And in between, if you see a big blacktail, you're just flat lucky.
Well, and that's what, as I say, Gary, I mean, coming from Ohio and then Iowa and being raised on whitetails, one of my questions was, you've hunted whitetails, I'm assuming over in the eastern part of your home state now, throughout the West, perhaps elsewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, my question is, for these Midwesterners, Great Plains folks who are moving out to the Pacific Northwest, is there a comparison? Is there any kind of comparison between whitetails, which actually do exist and you can see, and blacktails, which, you know, may be a figment of our imagination, unless your name's Cameron Hayes or you go to the Big Buck Show at the O'Loughlin Sportsman Show. You know, I never thought that I would have a deer bucket list, and I'm not a trophy hunter. I'm not, neither Julie or I are trophy hunters, but I would like to have an opportunity, blown or not, at a big, what I would call a big blacktail buck. Seen them, not during season. So is there a comparison between whitetails and blacktails of any kind?
Yeah, I would say if you're good at hunting whitetails, you can be good at hunting blacktails and vice versa. If you take the things you know about hunting trophy whitetails and you apply them to hunting blacktails, you're going to be successful. It's the floundering around that gets us mired in the unsuccess where we're trying to make sense of all of this. That it's the floundering around. If you know that the deer are there, they have very small home ranges. Yeah. And if you can get up in a high place and look down into their home, their core territory, you will see the deer. And eventually you'll see the buck. And because he's there all the time doing his thing, he's supremely aware. It's the same as a trophy whitetail.
Very interesting. Out here, actually, not very far from the house here, I've got a little orchard that I can watch. It's off limits as far as hunting is concerned, which is fine. But a little orchard where I can watch a lot of deer. And one evening I was sitting watching a couple little bucks, little spikes, forked horns, which is something I had to get used to. The Eastern count, Western count thing, because I came out to Washington and was still talking about, you know, 8 points and 10 points, and 12 points. And people would look at me going, wow, you know, yeah. You either just saw the buck, the biggest blacktail buck ever, or you're a liar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of times it was that second part.
Yeah.
But I was sitting watching a couple little bucks one evening when I noticed their body language, for lack of a better word, change. And about dusk, from out of the reed canary grass, swaggered this. I mean, to me, he was a monster, a 4x4, a 4x5. He was a dandy. And he walked out. The little ones ran off. He ate apples for a couple of minutes. Never, ever, ever saw him again. So I don't even know if he was real.
Yeah.
But what did I do with my, so the biggest challenge, and I think I'm not assuming, Gary, but I think I know where you're going to go with this. Here in Western Washington, Northwestern Oregon, Southwestern Washington, Western Washington, Western Oregon, coastal parts of the states. What is the biggest challenge when it comes to blacktails? Is it just flat seeing them?
Well, that's what it seems like, but you got to break it down to, you got to have a decent place to hunt. So you've got to get there one way or another, and it can be public land or it can be land that you lease from a private landowner, or it could be you have permission from somebody. You know, there's a lot of different ways but you got to break it down, and then you got to figure out where are the big blacktails living. They've got to have the water, the food, the shelter, and then the escape cover. Okay. And these are home ranges. When they begin their breeding season, they'll start to move, and they'll move into, you know, they'll bump into each other. And, you know, you mentioned the apple orchard. That was always my dream was to have an apple orchard to hunt in and around. And as I look back, I think, oh yeah, there was an apple tree there, which meant there was probably a homestead, you know, the homesteader that planted that apple tree. And it only takes one.
Sure.
Only takes one apple tree. But the thing that the Western hunter, the person who grew up in this area, Oregon, Washington, Northern California, they have a hard time sitting in one place. And you've got to be good at sitting in one place. And if you're not good at it, become good at it. I wasn't. One time, opening of archery season, my truck, the fuel filter got plugged. And I was way out, and I was able to coast 17 miles.
Wow.
You can imagine that. And I knew there was an auto mechanic. It was a Friday night before the season started. And I coasted into his driveway. And then I sat there while he replaced the fuel filter on my car, on my Toyota 4Runner at 5:30 p.m. And so I was lucky. And this guy was big, like a piano big. And he was a bow hunter. And he was telling me about killing deer and elk with his bow. And I thought, the only way he's doing that if he's sitting in one place. And here I was just struggling to, you know, see animals. And, you know, I was having some success, but I'm thinking as he's talking, he's more successful than me, or he's a better liar.
Right.
And I knew that where he was situated, he had a lot of people that were landowner friends. And so that was also important, but he knew where to sit. And so that's really the key, is if you know where to sit and you sit there, and if you can look down into the places where big bucks live and move, then you are on the other side of that line that divides us between the 75% that aren't successful and the 25% that are.
One of the things, and in keeping with this, if you don't know how to sit, and I think you're spot on, Gary, if you don't know how to sit, learn how to sit. For me, it's a double-edged sword out here. There's been a lot of growth, people moving into the area, homes being built, 20s becoming 10s, 10s becoming 5s, 5s becoming 2.5s.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we did in Iowa was we hunted suburban deer.
Yeah.
We hunted little blocks of private ground, 5 acres, 10 acres. One lady friend of ours had 66 acres that was literally full of deer, problematic. And that's what I'm finding, that on the one hand, I hate to see, hate is a strong word, I just as soon not see all the homes popping up and places being paved and big trees being cut. Not that I have anything against the timber industry. I do not. But on the one hand, I hate to see all of the urban sprawl. On the other hand, I do take advantage of that, perhaps hypocritically so, because the one place that I hunt, I mean, 3 minutes from our home, the folks have 5 acres. The lady of the house is always up in arms because the deer are always eating everything she even thinks about planting.
Yeah.
The fields of fire are very, very, very narrow. So what I did was I got a 20-foot ladder stand, put it up at the edge of their backyard, and it's a fantastic place to shoot. There's big bucks there. I've not killed what folks would consider a big buck, but I've killed some really nice deer that earned a spot in our freezer. And the landowner comes out and he's all happy because his wife is happy because one less blacktail is eating her rose bushes. So I guess we've just been kind of adapting in that way. Is it a wilderness setting? Is it a high buck hunt? No, it's not. But I can still make it aesthetically pleasing to me. And I get a lot of books read. So,
yeah. Okay. See, I think this is really the thing a person needs to do is what you've done. You've identified that the landscape is changing and the things that used to work here don't work as well anymore. And so you have to adapt, and we're being forced to adopt the East Coast model of deer hunting, you know, whether we like it or not. And the people that quit, you know, they're happy to live with their memories. I am not.
Right.
People say, did you have a good weekend, Gary? And I think, what? Because I'm looking forward to what's next. I don't dwell in the past.
Well,
and so I think what you're suggesting is having the ladder stand makes a lot of sense. There's places where big bucks live where you can't look down into their habitat. And I just drive by those places. I think, oh, I know a buck lives there. And I might even see him when he, you know, steps out to cross the road sometime. But if I know that hunting him would be very difficult. So I'm looking for other places. And so there's baiting. Okay. So that's one thing to consider and to know the rules in the area where you're hunting, but there's also scents and attractants. And you have to, if you're using doe and heat scent, it has to be synthetic. Okay. And there's also food attractant scents like these apple and persimmon and vanilla and different scents that deer will be attracted to, and a lot of different manufacturers that make that stuff. And the people that avail themselves of this mostly are people who have, you know, hunts. They hunt on the East Coast and the Midwest, and they use these things to draw animals out, but also to stop them in places where they want them to stop, you know, where a buck will stick his nose down into the dirt to smell this smell. And you have a moment where the buck is broadside or whatever. So that is also something to keep in mind and to have in your tool bag.
Something that you said just a minute ago, Gary, that was really interesting. You referred to the changing landscape and we're adopting out here. We're adopting these East Coast hunting methods. And I guess I've never thought of that. And that really does ring true. And that being said, by my own admission, I'm a sitter. Turkeys taught me how to sit for long periods of time. So I'm a sitter. We did a lot of deer drives there in the Midwest. The landscape was conducive to deer drives. They were exciting, but there was still an element of, you know, when you've got a line of individuals walking to you with guns and a line of individuals standing with guns, and, you know, hopefully the deer will be in between. There's still an element of, do I want to say uncertainty? You need a drive master. You need someone who knows the ground, so on and so forth. But something that I did very little of was still hunting. Still hunting is very, very traditional, where you take the 10 steps and stand for 5 minutes and take the 10 steps and stand for 10 minutes, which to me, though very effective, was, I don't want to say boring, Gary, but it's, anyway, my question is, with blacktails, is still hunting through a place a small parcel that you know holds deer? Is still hunting still a viable option? Or is this something that old guys just talk about over coffee in the morning?
If you're still hunting all the time, you're going to still be hunting on the last day of the season. It's one of those skills that you should try to develop it. But I find myself still hunting now to get through a place that I need to get through to get to the place I'm going to sit.
Got it.
And when I grew up, and we began hunting in the area around Kalama, Washington, and then Woodland, Washington. And then from there, I was hunting out east of Oregon City. We didn't know what we were doing, for one thing.
Right.
But we would get up well before daylight, and we would be in the woods well before the sunrise. And that was like a point of pride with the family members that I hunted with, you know, a little bit when I was young. It was fun to get up that early and eat breakfast and get out there and have the anticipation. But what you're doing is you're blowing it, because to get to where you want to go, you're passing all these deer and alerting them, and they in turn are alerting all the other deer. And that's what you risk by starting into the woods too soon. And so I like to now, I don't go in until I can see. And then that's when I'm doing the still hunting, and I'm still hunting to the place where I'm going to sit. That's generally how I approach it now. I mean, there's a lot of variables and things that change my approach, but I'm looking for one good buck. You know, and I know where he lives. So I got to be in that place, and I got to sit, and I got to look. And I remember blacktail hunting one season, and it was a 12-day season. And I hunted like 9 days out of the 12 or something like that. And I was on stand 95% of the time. I think I placed my stand in the exact right spot based on what I saw on my trail cameras. Big bucks, you know, one big buck that still haunts me, just a huge belly. You know, that's what I remember seeing. And I see the base of his antlers and not the tops. That thing was a monster. And I still have that picture, but I never did see that buck. But what I did wrong was I turned the stand to face out into the opening, which was about an acre in size, in this little meadow on public land. And I should have had the stand facing into the dark timber on the other side of the tree, where I would only see just a little bit of real estate. And I remember a deer walking up underneath my stand and then sensing I was there and turning, and before I could turn to see him. And I think that was my moment, and my tree stand was on the wrong side of the tree.
So you had been there a million times, Gary. You should have been looking at B and you were looking at A, and that's not how that played out.
Right. And I learned something there, and I called it a great season, and I passed up a forked horn. And you know, if you can pass up one good look at a buck, I mean, that's a pretty good season sometimes.
Well, and that's how, I mean, you and I, can I ask, how old are you now?
56.
I just turned 59. And I think we're at that point. I'm at that point where, I am trying to learn. You can teach that old dog new tricks. And this past waterfowl season was a perfect example of that. I mean, I learned more about what to do, what not to do. I mean, and I killed my first duck when I was 10 in 1974. So it's been a long time, but I learned a flat ton. And I learned a lot about geese and goose hunting. And I'm always learning about deer. I like, you know, I sit in that 20-foot stand and I watch, and I watch the jays, and I watch the, you know, the little fairy diddle, like a friend of mine used to call them, the fairy diddle squirrels, the little pine squirrels. And, and because it's a suburban setting, I do get to see a lot of deer. I see a lot of mama deer and little ones and this and that. And occasionally I'll see a buck that I want to take home and put in the freezer. But it's, I think you're absolutely, you are absolutely right that as long as it's a learning experience with an emphasis on the word experience, I think it's been a good day. It's been a good week. It's been a good season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I'm looking to see the deer before I shoot it, you know, and then I want to be able to go from observation mode into kill mode very right. quickly. It's right. you have to be able to throw that switch, because we walk around in cities and towns and in business meetings and stuff. We're not in the mode of needing to kill stuff all the time, but there is a moment where you got to be there, right. where you got to get there. You got to be ready for that moment.
And you do. And that's, you know, but it's nice being in the position we're in where we can really decide. This buck that I killed a couple years back, I had been watching one. I actually, and I'm not a phone person, I'm really not, but I had taken a couple pictures of him to send to Julie, and I blew him up. I thought it was a little doe, and it turned out he had little spikes about the size of your little finger on his head. Yeah. Said, you know what? Yeah. There's just no way. But I told myself, I said, there's no way that I'm going to shoot this little deer. And he wandered away, and I got to watch him. And right before dusk, here he comes back, literally right underneath the stand. And I thought, I get to see him again. And I heard something else. And he had a buddy with him. And this time he had spikes well above his ears. And I thought, you know, do I want? Yes, I do want to. So, and he was tremendous. He was a tremendous little deer. He was tremendous, you know, in the field. He was tremendous on the tables. So, pet blacktail rifle, what are you shooting? What's your go-to during rifle season, Gary?
I think a person is well served by a 7mm Magnum. Okay, so something like that. Last year it was the 27 Nosler, and this year it's going to be a 26 Nosler. I've killed lots of blacktails with the with 30-06, 243, 270s is great. But I just think that the 7mm is a good all-around choice. I'd say 160 grain Nosler Accubond would be my choice. What you really want to do is you want to put them down in the spot they're standing. That's why I'm specific about the caliber and the bullet. I don't want to have to try to find that deer. My biggest blacktail, he dropped right in the spot where I shot him, and it still took me 20 minutes to find him because the brush was so thick, and he hadn't even gone a step, but the brush was so thick that it was really hard to find him. And so you got to be sure, you know, of your shot. And then before you move, I like to tie a ribbon in the place I was standing. And then I like to get a good look through the brush, you know, line up this tree with that bush. And then that's the place I'm going to walk to. And if I walk to the wrong spot, then I can go back to where I was standing or sitting. And then see the, you know, my line and get back on it. But that has helped me find many, many deer by being methodical before I start the search.
Right. I grew up again in Ohio, spent time in Iowa, shotgun only states. So, you know, Washington was a novelty to me. I get to use a center fire rifle. We hunted groundhogs. We hunted woodchucks / groundhogs back in the Midwest. So I did a little bit of rifle shooting. I became a 243 Winchester guy. I've got several of them. I absolutely love them because I'm not a long range shooter. I'm just not. To each his or her own, but I'm just not. A couple years back, Linda Powell at Mossberg was kind enough to make available to me one of their Patriot bolt actions in that 350 Legend, which I thought was, you know, this is just trendy. This is just hype. It is an incredibly accurate little gun. And I have yet to shoot a deer with it, but I know on paper and I feel very, very comfortable with it. The last buck that I killed a couple of years back, I killed with my late uncle's Marlin 336C in 30-30. I really wanted to shoot a deer with that little gun. And I finally did. He went about, I don't, 10 steps. So I was very, very impressed with that. But like I say, I mean, it's like the Legend to me is 125, 150 yard gun. But where I hunt here in the southwest corner, I mean, I'm looking out the window now, Gary, and I can see 175 yards, but that includes a road and somebody's lawn. So
And you know, as we out in parts of the West are forced to adopt Eastern and Midwest tactics, you know, a rifle and caliber choice like that makes a lot of sense. From where I'm sitting, I can see the spot where I killed my first deer, and it's probably 18 miles away.
Wow. That's cool.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to say is if you want to be a successful blacktail hunter, I'm speaking to people that were, you know, like me when I was in my 20s, you have to, I think, immerse yourself in the culture of blacktail hunting and surround yourself with blacktail hunters and read the stuff that people poured their hearts into. And so I would say required reading includes Boyd Iverson's trophy hunting, blacktail trophy hunting book. There's try to get the second volume of that, the second edition of that. Cameron Haynes' bow hunting trophy blacktails book provides a lot of insight, and you read that book and you read between the lines and you get an idea of the tactics that he was using. And then the North American, or the record book for Oregon big game and the record book for Washington big game, you know, there's a lot of good information in those record books, that in the stories between the records. And they also published a book on hunting blacktails. And I would say after you feel like you've read all of those, and I would say include my deer hunting book in that list as well, then read Trophy Blacktails, The Science of the Hunt by Scott Haugen. Okay. And I would read that book last, because Scott builds on the other writing, and he takes it in some cases a step further and helps synthesize and bring it all together. So you not only understand the animal, but you understand the various subcategories of the animal that live in different parts of Oregon, live in different parts of Washington. And then we don't ever want to forget about those Sitka blacktails up there in Alaska either.
I had an opportunity to interview Scott. Scott's a very good friend of ours.
Yeah.
And had an opportunity to interview Scott here all 2 or 3 weeks ago. And he was very, very interesting, as you say, very analytical, very step-by-step. I learned a lot during that conversation. And there is, you know, to come back full circle, Gary, I think that there is quite a bit of overlap for folks coming out from the Midwest or the Great Plains or folks who are familiar with whitetails and whitetail ways. There's overlap. I think in some cases, like a turkey, whether it's a Miriam's Rio, Eastern, Osceola, turkey, a gobbler is a gobbler is a gobbler. Mm-hmm. But each one's a little bit different. And I think that from what I've seen, and I've only been hunting these mythical beasts out here since 93, with, I would say, a moderate amount of success, that if you know what it is you're doing with deer in general, scent elimination, the use of scents, all of the tools, as you called them, the tools in your toolbox, calling, rattling, scouting, patience, the ability to sit. I think that sooner or later, one will make a mistake. You will cross paths with one. Something good, where good translates into you killing a nice buck, something will happen.
Okay, so we talked about, you mentioned rattling, and that's a thing that a person should be good at, like you should be good at still hunting. And when you are rattling and calling, you want to expect that it's going to work. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what that means is you want your rifle ready or an arrow on the string, because when the deer shows up, it's going to be looking right at you. And you've got to be able to move when you have your chance. And you don't just call and then hope that they all come in and stand around.
Right.
But my first experience as a young person with big blacktail bucks was watching two huge bucks fight over a doe. And then while those two bucks were trying to kill each other, and that's what they were doing, they were trying to kill each other, another buck came in that was just as big as those two and hooked that doe and took her away.
Yeah, sure.
And I saw, we went and got a guy who had a tag. And here I am, a 10-year-old, and I watched this guy miss shots at these bucks. And then, you know, his gun jammed and he's digging it with a pocket knife and these deer are running away. And I thought, man, I don't ever want to be like this. I want to have everything in order when I get a chance at a big buck.
And I, again, Gary, I think you're spot on. And I go back to turkey hunting. Years ago, I told a very good friend of mine, Phil Borgeli, who writes for Field and Stream. I know you know Phil. I told him that there in Iowa, I said, every time I hit a lick on a turkey call, every time I call, I expect to hear a gobble. And that keeps me on my toes. It's a confidence booster. It's psychologically good. Does it always happen that way? No. But every time I call, I expect something to happen. And I think if you get in that mindset, if you're ready before you do it, and again, turkey hunting, so many times I've heard stories of guys, you know, I just thought I'd call one last time and the bird gobbled and he was 40 yards away and he comes around the corner and he sees me and he runs away. You know, be ready. If you take a casual, you know, I don't want to say lackluster, but if it's a half-hearted attempt, either give it your all and be ready, as you say, or pack them up and go home and try it again when your head's in the game.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that I try to remember is that all of us, we all tend to do things the same way. Okay, so we park in the same places as the guy did last year, as our grandpa did 30 years ago. You know, a wide spot on the road was a wide spot on the road back then. So when you park in the same place as the last guy, you're probably going to walk the same path the last guy walked. And when we're in society, you know, when we come to an intersection, it's easier for us to turn right than it is for us to turn left. So in the woods, we tend to turn right more often. And at a fork, we tend to take the right fork instead of the left one. Do the opposite thing. So if you find a place where there's no parking spots, there's probably a pocket of ground. It might be an acre or 5 acres that's not getting people's attention. It might be 50 acres. And if you do the opposite thing, sitting in one place, you know, up high, looking down into openings, that is the opposite thing from what other people are doing. Studying maps. I can look at a topo map and tell you where a deer is right at this minute. And, you know, I can tell you by looking at a topo map where the deer bed and where they go to escape. And ever since ever since 1999, I've been able to draw an X on a map and go to that spot and kill that buck.
And that is, you know, that is almost, I want to say, Gary, it's almost a lost art with things like, you know, Google Maps and Google Earth and Onyx. And
I love Onyx. And Google Earth has made me a far better hunter, but there's no substitute for a paper map.
Oh, no. You know, and something that you said here just 60 seconds ago or so, I think human beings are bigger is better. So if I've got 5,000 acres or 10,000 acres or 50,000 acres, my chances of success are better than if I've got two.
Yeah.
Well, the deer, that buck can't be on 50,000 acres all at once. And as you say, blacktails, I think a lot more, you know, with the rut being an exception, blacktails are a lot more homebodies than our whitetails. So if you can narrow that 100 acres down to two, or the best two that have escape cover, or they have a certain kind of feed, or there is an old homestead buried back in there with one apple tree that has, you know, a dozen apples on it. You know, instead of looking at the big picture, if you can look at just a little section of it, which can be difficult. And that's basically what I've done here around home, intentionally and unintentionally due to these, due to the growth and the fact that, as I said, the 20s become 10s and the 10s become 2.5s. And so a lot of times these new landowners have narrowed these choices down for me, which in some cases has worked out real well.
I'd rather have 2 good acres than 200 acres or 2,000.
Absolutely. And it's no different than turkey hunting. It's no different than duck hunting. You know, you may have a 500 acre field and the geese want a 1/4 acre of it for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, is it high? Is it low? Is there, you know, the most of the feed is there. They're not going to be on 500 acres all at once. You know, unless you've got 50,000 snows and they're covering it up. But go ahead.
What I'm looking at is I want a topo map. I want a paper topo map that has really good detail on it. And then if I can compare that to an aerial photo, then the picture just really opens up for me. And so, instead of an aerial photo, most of the time I'm using Google Earth.
Right. Well, I'm sure looking forward to this fall. I've got, it's been 2 years since I've killed a deer. The freezer is getting a little slim. But more important than that, I've had, Julie and I've had 2 of the grandkids out here. Adriana will be 16 in November. Tristan's 12. They just successfully passed Hunter Ed.
Great.
They've hunted waterfowl with me as observers. So this year they're actually going to get into the mix. And I think we'll do a little bit of maybe side-by-side two-person tree stands or ground blinds. Oh, yeah. Ground blinds are great things for kids.
I love ground blinds, man. Now,
you can...
I got my first ground blind because of Scott Haugen.
Ah.
And I invested time in hunting in it that year, and I thought, okay, I like this.
Right. They're nice. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the concept and the theory. I'm not, for turkey hunting, I wasn't a huge fan of them for myself because I like to hunt on my feet. Yeah. I can sit if sitting is what I need to do, and I can sit still because my father raised me as a squirrel hunter. Mm. So you sit and you sit still and you watch with your eyes, not with your arms and your legs. But I like to hunt turkeys on my feet. So being inside a ground blind was kind of, that was nerve-wracking for me. But if you have kids, Julie and I used to work with a lot of folks with mobility issues. You can put them in a chair. You can drop a ground blind over a wheelchair and have them sit and read your book and eat your old Pop-Tarts and take a nap. And I'm huge on that. 59, I'm huge on naps.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always loved a good nap. That's part of the joy for me of being a hunter is I could just lay down under any tree and sleep, you know.
Oh, it's very, very nice. And I can remember, you know, hunting. We had a very long turkey season in Iowa, and after 3 weeks, those naps. And I would stay in the field all day, but that time, you know, we as writers always wrote about some of the best turkey hunting time is between 10 and 2 when the hens have gone to the nest and the gobblers are long. I'm sleeping. You know, I don't know. The gobblers are doing pirouettes in the decoys and I'm out.
Yeah.
So, Gary, have a real good season this fall. I sure do appreciate your time. It's a busy time for us. I know we got salmon, we got steelhead, we got dove season coming up on the 1st of September. We've got an early goose season on the 2nd of September for 10 days that we're going to get in on. I'm going to get the grandkids involved with that. I know the neighbor boy is shooting his bow every evening. He'll do the deer and elk thing in September. So, it's going to be a good fall.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. And conversations like this just get me primed.
Oh, absolutely. Anymore, I'm starting to get to be that the coffee clutch old guy who likes to, we'll call it reminisce.
Yeah, I'm good with that too. Just don't ask me what I did last weekend. Troy Rodakowski, welcome back to Ballistic Chronicles.
It's a great pleasure to be back, Gary.
You and I and Troy Ralston from Bailey Seed Company sat down and talked about the things that a blacktail hunter needs to do. And we all have a lot in common and we come at this from different perspectives. And I talked to Troy last week, but I want to talk to you specifically about how to hold deer on a piece of property, big or small.
Well, deer, as you know, are going to be there because of they're going to want to feel safe. They're going to want food and they're going to need water.
Escape cover, feed, water, and bedding area. What you guys came up with is a seed mix, and we're calling it the Frontier Unlimited Seed Mix. It's a wildlife mix for deer, for turkeys, and for elk. And it'll seed approximately 1 to 1.5 acres, and it's white clover, forage brassica seed, and ryegrass seed.
Yes, and we have the options of doing custom mixes that include daikon radish and turnips and other legumes. If requested.
Okay. Now we're here in August. It's early August. How can somebody get started and be ready for blacktail season and try to hold animals on a piece of property?
I think right now people need to be picking out their spots where they're going to want a mix to go, you know, or a supplement area. And you got to get the soil prepared. You got to either get the ground cleared or tilled or raked or even just cleared enough to broadcast seed. And you want to get this done as soon as possible because you want to hit it before the fall rains come. and have the seed there and ready to germinate once the fall rains come. And if you have the ability to irrigate it, I mean, right now, you can start right now. But that between now and the middle of September is prime time to really start thinking about this stuff and getting this stuff going for fall and heading into winter.
And so if I was getting my ground prepared, I would be looking at the weather forecast and watching for when I'm expecting rain to come and try to plant before that.
Right. A lot of that seed will sit there for a really long time, even if you seed it, you know, a month ahead of the first rain. But being the early bird to get that worm, you're going to want to make sure your ground's ready. So it's not too early to start now and get that seed in stock, have it ready to go and get it seeded, you know, right before, you know, you get that first good rain.
You know, we've had some of this product out being tested right now. What are you seeing from trail camera pictures?
So I've got a couple individuals that have been sending me pictures all summer because they put it in this spring. An amazing number of great animals, antler growth, turkeys, elk, blacktail bucks, some of the biggest velveted blacktail bucks I've seen in a long time. And this is a dry year. So, you know, the forage isn't like it normally would be on a normal year with normal precipitation. They got these food plots in early enough that the antler growth is phenomenal. And the deer and turkeys and elk, they just keep coming back.
Okay. So the way somebody can buy this, they can go to my website, GaryLewisOutdoors.com, and then go to the store and read about it there. The price is $44.95 for a bag of this it's a 5-pound bag?
Yep, 5-pound bags. And we can do larger bags upon request. 5-pound bags will usually seed about an acre and a half. But if you need larger bags, like 25-pound bags or something even bigger, you can make a request for that and we can do a custom mix.
Okay, so for questions, they can reach out to you. What's a good email?
The best email to get a hold of me for questions of anything about wildlife and our wildlife mixes is trodakowski, trodakowski, at baileyseed.com.
And the website for Bailey Seed is?
www.baileyseed.com.
And then you can learn about it on my site, GaryLewisOutdoors.com, and email me, GaryLewisOutdoors@gmail.com. Or if you want to make an order, call me, 541-420-1371. There's a picture of a buck that you and I took that picture when we were together. And it reminds me of our mutual friend who has passed away, but he was so good at keeping bucks on his property, Boyd Iverson.
Yes. And Boyd's actually the one that kind of started this. Boyd and I were working on it together on Boyd's property before Boyd passed, unfortunately. And I kind of made it a goal that, you know, I needed to continue this. And I know you and I have talked about it for years. So here it is. This is years and years of work and research, you know, to bring wildlife onto your property. So we're passing our knowledge and what we know onto you and hoping everybody enjoys what we have for years.
Frontier Unlimited wildlife mixes, 5-pound bag, seeds approximately 1 to 1.5 acres. It's $44.95, and you can get it now and get it in the ground and be ready for those fall rains.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Troy.
Thanks, Gary. Good talking to you, buddy.
Hey guys, we have two really good coffees at GaryLewisOutdoors.com. There's the Frontier Roast, which is a medium dark, and then we have the Fishing Central Oregon Reserve Roast, which is a blend of Colombian and Sumatran and Panamanian, which gives it that crema on top. You're going to love these coffees. And I've got Don Grissett on the line.
We only use select or what they call grade one coffees at Expedition Joe because, you know, we just don't want to mess with the other stuff. Starbucks and all these other big chain type organizations are buying probably in their best grades. They might be buying grade two, you know, so it goes from grade one to grade five. And it has there's a lot of things in the grading scales that determine what level it's going to be at. you know, they do what they call it. They use a screen. So when you pour the coffee through the screen, there's only a certain percentage of the coffee beans that can actually go through the screen to be called a select grade or a grade one coffee. We wanted to make sure that, you know, everything that we're providing out there is going to get a 5-star rating, to be honest, because we are primarily an internet-based company, you know, putting out a pretty darn good cup of coffee. As you know, smooth is the word. Your coffees are really great. Are you using your Fishing Central Oregon coffee as a potential espresso? Have you been making any espressos with it?
Yeah, every single day, every single day. And that's what I'm sipping on right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The that makes, while it makes a fantastic classic pot of coffee in your drip machine or your French press or whatever your method of making your coffee, it's an awesome, it's the best. I've never had another cup of espresso that can beat that yet. And so that one's interesting because it has a little bit of, it's a blend. It has a little bit of a Colombian, some Sumatran coffee in there as well, because of the flavor you get from Sumatran. Mm-hmm. And then what makes the crema, which is that nice layer on the top after you pull your shot, is from the Panamanian. So most people don't think of Panama when they think of coffee, but again, it's got a lot of high mountainous regions as well. And so you get a really nice crema from that Panamanian. That's sort of the, you put those three together, it's really hard to beat. On your website, we have a direct link that comes to the back end of our website.
GaryLewisOutdoors.com.
Yeah, that just allows them to make a real simple, you get come to a basically a Gary Lewis page, and it's got your two coffees, and hopefully we'll be talking a third one here in the near future.
You can find our coffees at GaryLewisOutdoors.com.